You're listening to Viewpoints, the podcast, our best interviews from our nationally syndicated talk radio show. If you're looking for smart, fun radio to get you thinking, this is the place. We'd love to hear from you. So if you have comments or questions, feedback for us or suggestions, send us an email, viewpoints@bellmedia.ca. Again, viewpoints@bellmedia.ca. All right, let's get back to more of those viewpoints right now. Smart Fun Radio to get you thinking and get you talking. I'm Todd Vanderhayden. Election mania. The federal election is here. Millions of Canadians voting on Monday. It's a decision deadlock, though, a stalemate in the polls. And we've never really seen something quite this close before. Yes, we had minority governments in the past, but there's something going on in this campaign. Maybe it's the lack of a big issue or the lackluster race itself, or perhaps for the leaders, Justin Trudeau and Andrew Scheer, Liberal and Conservative, maybe voters are disappointed or disillusioned with those two, with their choices. And so we see this tie game. Now, at this point, it looks like the odds are still slightly in favor of the Trudeau Liberals. Why? Because their support is more broadly based across more provinces. And the way our parliamentary system works, that actually favors them slightly. But we don't know yet. And either way, it seems highly unlikely we're going to have a majority government, which means a minority government, possibly with a new Democrats helping out Justin Trudeau. Yes, there could be a shift in the final days that might affect where we're going to see things as of Monday night. And by the way, we might not even know. It might be Tuesday or Wednesday before this all gets sorted out. Lydia Miljan is back with us in Windsor, Ontario. She's with the University of Windsor, political commentator. It is kind of messy, isn't it? It's kind of sort of murky how this is all going to play out, Lydia.
Yes, there are so many great unknowns, and I think, you know, I agree with your introduction that a lot depends on the efficiency of the vote. I mean, the Conservatives look like they're neck and neck with the Liberals nationally, but the problem for them is that they've got actually too much support in Western Canada. There's only so many seats that they can pick up, so even though I think some polls suggesting over 60% of the public are thinking of voting Conservative, especially in the province of Alberta, there's just a fixed number of seats that they can get there. And their problem is, can they pick up seats in battleground Ontario and also places like Quebec and British Columbia? And that's where the Liberals have a little bit of an advantage. They're somewhat more competitive in Quebec, though. The Bloc Québécois are nipping at their heels. And then there seems to be this really messy race coming out in British Columbia. So, yes, election night this time is going to be down to the wire.
I know there are people listening right now who are not happy with their choices, and they say, you know what, I might end up making the least bad choice, but I don't really want to have to vote for either the red team or the blue team. Maybe some people are actually interested in the orange team because of the popularity of Jagmeet Singh. So, you know, his politics might not quite match with them, but they feel that he's more genuine or for whatever reason he resonates more. What does that say, though, about Trudeau and Scheer?
Yeah, I think it's a sort of a pox in both their houses, and I think it's a different criteria depending on the leader. I mean, Jagmeet Singh certainly got a post-debate bounce, and he's still riding high on that. For Justin Trudeau, I think the problem for him is more about broken promises, and he's, you know, I think that the tagline that the Conservatives put on him was quite effective. He's not as advertised. You know, his credentials of being a feminist, as being a climate change champion, all these types of things have really fallen flat, and he's hurt lots of key constituents, notably Indigenous people. And so I think that the drop in his support is because of his personal failings, shall we say, blackface, for example. On the other hand, Andrew Scheer just hasn't connected with Canadians. He's pleasant enough. I think most people think he's friendly enough, but I don't know if they have a real sense of him. And that's always the concern for conservative leaning parties is the prospect of a hidden agenda. And where the Liberals were quite effective in terms of branding Andrew Scheer was raising the questions regarding his views on same-sex marriage, his views on other social issues like abortion. Even though he's said he's going to abide by the law and has no interest in those things, it cast a pall on his chances, and I think that's what sort of stalled his numbers. So a lot depends now for the next few days on getting the votes out, getting the efficiency. For the Liberals, it's really important to get the vote out. Their biggest threat is not that Liberals are going to switch parties to the NDP, which is partly a problem, more so how many of them are just not going to vote at all. Are we going to have a decline in voter turnout this time around? I think that's probably what's keeping them up at night.
It's also been ugly, too. I mean, the conservatives basically saying that the Trudeau government, especially if it were to be propped up sort of on an ad hoc basis, even by an NDP quasi-alliance, that would lead to Canada being pushed ever deeper into the red, you know, debts as far as we can see, and just spending like drunken sailors. And the Liberals, on the other hand, sort of talking about cultural issues, abortion, same-sex marriage, that those could be under threat, that Andrew Scheer could roll back social programs, make deep cuts like some of the provincial premiers who are conservatives have done. I mean, this kind of thing, scaremongering, fearmongering, does it motivate voters or does it turn people off?
That's the big question. I think in some respects, I think it's turning people off. I even sort of had chats with other political scientists, and some of us are just saying, you know what, we just want to turn it off. Like, it's exhausting, just the claims and counterclaims. And I think that's the big concern, is that are we, by going so negative, the political parties, are they really turning away voters and not allowing them to be engaged? And I guess it's also frustrating that we're talking about issues that aren't on anybody's platform. It's like, you know, why don't we actually just talk about the platform? As opposed to invoking the idea that a party may or may not do something. I mean, the Conservatives are just as bad as the Liberals. And the Liberals bring up social issues, but the Conservatives are, you know, hinting towards legalizing all drugs that the other parties might want to do, or raising the GST. I mean, that kind of stuff is fine if it was actually in their platforms, but just making stuff up, I think, really frustrates the electorate.
The other thing I'm curious about is, you know, there's a bit of a test going on here as to whether Canada is immune to the forces we see around the world, whether it's the United States or over in Europe and other places, sort of the forces of populism. You've got Max Bernier and the People's Party of Canada. They're not polling very high at all. We'll see if there are so-called shy Bernier supporters out there who may not be telling the pollsters what they really want to do. But that aside, I mean, when you look at what we've seen in a lot of key allies of Canada in elections, let's say going back the last three and a half years, Canada's been a little bit of an oasis for liberalism, so to speak, and certainly the progressives out there are very happy about that. But now you have a wounded prime minister who is vulnerable, has made a lot of gaffes of his own doing, really, and you know, a lot of promises that weren't kept, and maybe, you know, really, Trudeau mania is gone now. What do you think we're going to see? Does that have an effect on Canada, what's going on out there beyond our borders?
I think it does. I think populism is real, and I think that it comes from a frustration of the Liberal agenda that it's a bit too politically correct. It's too focused on identity politics. One of the reasons why we might have sort of skated by at this time, and why maybe the People's Party is not going to have the inroads they expected, is because of the broken promise of Justin Trudeau of not pursuing electoral reform. Had we gone to electoral reform and had some form of proportional representation, I think that would put Maxime Bernier in a much stronger position, because his votes would matter more, and it would give people a chance to be much more strategic in their voting, especially if they were the shy conservative voters. They might want to go that way. So in some respects, that broken promise might have actually helped us skate by a potential problem, because the issue with European countries and other countries that have proportional representation is it does reward extreme parties. It also rewards disproportionately regional parties, and that's the other thing which is my biggest concern about this election, is the regional divides. It's the pitting of Alberta against Quebec. I think that's really unhealthy for our democracy, and if we were to go to some PR form of system, you would get a lot more of these kinds of schisms in our society, and it would be that much even more difficult to get kind of consensus on the issues that matter most.
Before we go, let me ask you about that, because I have heard, and people have been on this program, you know, from Alberta, who have said, you know, we got to be careful. If this is a Liberal minority government that's propped up by the NDP, that's going to be very bad for Canadian unity, especially this sort of west-east Alberta-Quebec divide, even Alberta-Ontario divide. What concerns you the most?
Yeah, that does concern me the most. I think that the, you know, and it's the rhetoric and the language of the Liberals in particular. I mean, it's been pointed out by others that, you know, Justin Trudeau, when he's in English Canada, says he's in it for Canada, but when he's Quebec, he's standing up for Quebec. He doesn't do that in Alberta. I don't even know if he's only been to Alberta once in this entire election campaign, and that was at the beginning. You know, the fact that you know, somehow Canadian oil is being vilified on the world stage and within our own borders tells people in Western Canada that they have a concern. And it's not just Alberta, it's Saskatchewan, and it's also Manitoba. And that's a big part of the nation that is being ill-served by this campaign.
Lydia Miljan joining us from Windsor, Ontario, political scientist at the university there with her take on this election. This is Viewpoints, the podcast. And a quick note from us to you, you can listen to our full nationally syndicated radio show on weekends right across Canada on different Bell Talk radio stations. Check your local listings for those. Meantime, if you want to contact me via social media, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. Same handle for both of those, at ToddCTV. A constitutional crisis, a president perhaps just months away from impeachment, a foreign policy crisis in the Middle East, and in the background, a looming presidential election just over a year from now. This is the state of the United States. Let's talk about this situation in Syria. The U.S. had a small number of troops in that country. President Trump decided to pull them out, controversial choice. Turkey sees this as a tacit green light, launches an invasion in northern Syria. Now the Syrian dictatorship and others moving into that vacuum. Trump under fire for weakening the U.S., for throwing allies under the bus and allowing rivals like Russia and Iran, maybe even ISIS, to sort of fill the void, rebuild. Big vote in Congress on Wednesday, overwhelmingly against Trump and what he has done, including many Republicans. Trump saying, listen, this is not our business, not our problem. Iran on ending those endless wars and godforsaken places. I'm just doing what I said I would do. Steve Farnsworth is back with us. He's with the University of Mary Washington, political commentator. He's been following this as well. Foreign policy fiasco, Steve, or a promise kept? What do you think?
Well, like everything with President Trump, it depends on your perspective. There's no doubt about it, though. This issue has generated more discontent among Republicans on Capitol Hill than pretty much anything that Trump has done in his presidency so far. So I think that the immediate aftermath of what has happened in Syria after the U.S. Decision has been really problematic from the point of view of foreign policy. It's, you know, now Trump is threatening sanctions and stricter sanctions still against Turkey. There's Russian troops on the ground, increased influence for them. Syria, the Syrian leadership, they got a third of the country back, and the Kurds have had to switch sides. So when you look through the wreckage of the 2 weeks of the Syria policy, it's pretty hard to argue that this worked out okay.
The other thing that's very scary is that the Americans, as you know, have nuclear weapons based at a Turkish base. And you know, the question becomes, you know, if you're in a showdown with Turkey, which is, of course, a member of NATO, you talk about destroying the Turkish economy, sanctions against them, and yet you've got those nukes in Turkey under American control. But nevertheless, you sort of wonder how the heck that's actually going to play out. Why would the president do this? I mean, it's not as if there were 50,000 American troops. I believe there was only 1,000 or so in Syria.
Yeah, and of course, they weren't really in harm's way in the same way that troops on the ground would be in forward positions. And so this was a situation in Syria that had sort of flown under the radar, in part because the troops were more operating in an advisory capacity and weren't actually doing a lot of the fighting. There were some aerial bombardments and intelligence that were efforts that were underway as well. But again, boots on the ground is where you really see the casualties mount up. And the Kurds have been taking basically a lot of that front. I mean, this is a very tough thing to spin from the point of view of America's adversaries. This is it's a big win for Syria. It's a big win for Russia. And certainly if you're China or Iran, the willingness of the Trump administration to walk away from the situation in Syria might make you think that you have better leverage against Washington than you might have thought otherwise. It is not a pretty picture from the perspective of American credibility.
Yeah, the idea of this president sort of pulling back from foreign engagements, you know, and that does allow others, as you say, Russia, China, Iran, to sort of step forward. And, you know, and then, of course, what does that create? What about the impeachment crisis, Steve? We're hearing, you know, that there are going to be hearings and witnesses and testimony, and that public sentiment really does seem to be shifting in favor of this inquiry. The president getting more and more angry and astonishing in some of the things he's doing and his behavior. and this short timeline, too. I mean, I read this recently that the Democrats want to vote on this within the next 2 or 3 months. They want this to be over by the end of the year or at least January.
Well, the point here for Democrats is that they have to worry about this effort being seen as an attempt to unseat President Trump in the short advance of the 2020 presidential election next November. So basically, the Democrats are trying to move as quickly as they possibly can in order to put as much daylight as possible between that election next November and the decision that they make. Sort of the intel on the Hill suggests that we could be looking at a House impeachment vote around, if maybe a little before, the American Thanksgiving in late November. So that would give investigators another 5 weeks or so at the most to try to work this out. That decision then, of course, if the House votes to impeach, and that seems quite likely, the Democratic majority is very few people who are hesitant to proceed, as far as we can tell right now. That means the Senate would be spending much of December dealing with the format of a trial, effectively, on the president. But there's no doubt about it. This is creating a very difficult environment for the Trump presidency. People are wondering who's going to be subpoenaed next. They're wondering what documents are going to be leaked or provided to the committee. And certainly, as individuals are facing the possibility that they themselves might end up in jail or face criminal sanctions, they have to weigh, do they want to take those risks on behalf of Donald Trump? And that is always a personal decision. Now, in the case of Watergate, there were some people around the president who were willing to go to jail for the president. This was also true in the case of the Iran-Contra affair. But I'm not sure that Donald Trump inspires the kind of loyalty among subordinates that Nixon and Reagan did.
Steve Farnsworth is my guest with the University of Mary Washington, political commentator, giving us his take about what's going on in the U.S. A lot of situations, this foreign policy crisis in Syria, the impeachment crisis as well domestically in the U.S., and also the Democrats, Steve, having their fourth debate this past week in Ohio. Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, who is the front runner, I think, or certainly her and former Vice President Joe Biden. She's raised a lot of money, but she is on the left. She came under a lot of fire. I'm curious where you sort of see this at now. We had 12 people up on stage, bit of a circus there. Who do you think kind of won, or at least didn't lose?
Well, I really think that three of the 12 had a big night. I think when you have a 12-person field, we really don't want to just name one winner. I think, first of all, Bernie Sanders had a good night. There were a lot of questions about his health in the wake of his recent heart attack. He, of course, is at the age of 78, of an age where people might be particularly concerned about stamina and health across the very demanding job of being a president. He was effective, bringing out the issues that he cared about. He really seemed like the same old Bernie, although perhaps a bit more humorous than he sometimes is in public. So he didn't have a bad night at all. With respect to Peter Buttigieg, another person had a strong night. I think he's in a position to do well if Biden continues to sink. I don't think Biden had a particularly good night. He doesn't seem all that good at these debates. He's not effective. His answers aren't crisp. And ironically, one of the biggest signs that Biden may not be the threat that people thought he would be in the Democratic field a while ago is that he was largely ignored. The other winner, the third winner, though, besides the mayor of South Bend and the senator from Vermont, is Elizabeth Warren. The good news when you're a front runner is you get a lot of time to talk and a lot of attention focused on you. The bad news is everybody aims their fire at you. But she is an effective debater and did pretty well in that environment, as she has on the way in those previous debates. I think she's had consistently, over the course of the debate so far, the strongest individual performance. Now, being good at debates doesn't necessarily mean that you would be good at being president, but certainly as the Democratic voters are looking at this field, Elizabeth Warren has grown in the support that she's received.
With all due respect to professors such as yourself, Steve, there are those who say she's too professorial, she's not charming enough, she has an issue with African-American voters, doesn't connect there, she's too wonkish, and that Donald Trump would just eat her for breakfast if she was to be the Democratic nominee for president.
Well, you know, Todd, you and I never disagree about anything. So, so don't ask me to do so here. I guess the point I would make in response to that is that that she has given as good as she's gotten in terms of the other Democrats. And the reality in American politics right now is that Donald Trump is a highly polarizing figure. Whenever you look at head-to-head competitions, whether it would be Trump and Biden or Trump and Sanders or Trump and Warren or Trump and Harris, over and over again, the polls show almost exactly the same thing. Donald Trump is at 42, 43, 44% against pretty much any of the major Democrats in the field. And so it's not clear to me that that Donald Trump is in a position to change a lot of minds in this election cycle. I think most people have made their mind up. Do they like Donald Trump? Do they not? And so in some ways, I think that the choice of a Democrat may be less significant than the way in which Donald Trump is basically facing a referendum. And so people will vote for or against four more years of the current president. And right now the polls suggest that that's an environment the Democrats would benefit from.
Steve is with the University of Mary Washington. All right, and we've got a lot more of those viewpoints coming up in the podcast. Meantime, leave a review for us, what you think of our show. Spread the word as well. We love to get feedback. Connect with us on social media. If you like what you're hearing, let us know via Twitter or Instagram. You can tag me at ToddCTV is my handle for both Twitter and Instagram. And you can contact us, as always, via email as well, viewpoints@bellmedia.ca. Great guests and great conversations. This is Viewpoints. I'm Todd Vanderhaten. Big election coming up. The outcome is unknown. We don't know which way this is going to go. And I know in the media we love a horse race, right? It sells newspapers, makes people tune into the television, makes people listen to radio. But this time around, if you look at all the polls by all the different research companies that are smart people, they've been doing this for years in our country, they're all saying the same thing, that we basically don't know who's going to end up in front on Monday night. It could take a couple of days to sort it all out. One thing I will say, the red team, the Liberals, do have a slightly better chance of forming the next government, although in all likelihood not a majority government, simply because of the way the Liberal support is. It's more broad-based. You know, Conservatives very concentrated in rural Canada and in Western Canada, Alberta, Saskatchewan, but we know that Ontario and Quebec have got almost 200 seats out of 338, and that's always been an advantage for the Liberals. Sunny Ways, Trudeau mania, remember that? The charismatic, dashing, glamorous Canadian Prime Minister on the cover of GQ, the selfies, the cool socks. The reality is, for Justin Trudeau, much or maybe most of that is now gone. It's kind of remarkable to think how quickly it went out the window. Some people are upset with him, broken promises on electoral reform, or SNC-Lavalin, the blackface scandal, and on and on and on it goes. And yet, Canada does tend to be a middle-of-the-road kind of country, and we do tend to re-elect prime ministers at least to a second term. Dan Moulton is back here on the show with us. He's a Liberal strategist to give us his take, and I guess there's a lot of nerve-wracking things going on for you guys right now, Dan, as we come to the final hours.
Yeah, I think we're down to that part of the campaign where everybody's nerves are at their highest point. Everybody's fixated on getting as many people out to vote as possible. And I think that's the one you talk about, what's uncertain about this campaign where we are right now. There's a lot of uncertainty, but the biggest thing we don't know is just how many people are going to actually show up to cast their vote on Monday. And that's really what's going to determine the outcome of this election.
Are you worried about that voter turnout? Because you know, I know, a lot of people out there listening will know that for you guys, turnout is key. You got to get people out there to vote. That's what helped you win that majority government in 2015, which was so astonishing. I mean, people need to remember, at this time 4 years ago, give or take, I mean, the Liberals were the third party. Justin Trudeau was an untested leader. We thought it was going to be either Prime Minister Stephen Harper or Prime Minister Tom Mulcair. You guys come from behind and sweep and win 150 more seats, give or take. Now, it's a very different situation, and people don't seem to be so into Trudeau anymore and may not vote for him, or may just stay at home. It doesn't mean they vote NDP or Green. They might just say, you know what, to heck with all the bums.
Yeah, I would say that, like, what's very clear right now is that the race hasn't actually shifted all that much since the start of this election. That's pretty atypical for an electoral process, right? You talked about the last election in which, you know, at the outset and throughout, we didn't know who was going to win, but there was certainly a growing momentum for the Liberals throughout, and their numbers dramatically changed over the course of that election. We haven't seen that in this election, right? I think you look at the polling today, it's about exactly where it was when we started this thing 4 weeks ago. Not many people's votes are moving around. And I think that that really does lead to a slight advantage to the Liberals. Their vote is more efficient, as we described it. They are able to turn out vote in Ontario and Quebec in very strategically important ridings that put them in first in those races, or have the potential to put them in first. But as you say, it's going to be all about getting those people actually to show up at the polls on Monday.
Why do you think it is so tight? You know, I've interviewed a lot of strategists, such as yourself, liberal and conservative strategists and political scientists. And, you know, what you hear from the blue team and the red team is that the other team is terrible and this is going to be awful. And you know, you can't vote for them. But obviously the message is not resonating for either of the two main parties because it's so darn close. What's happening?
I think that is going to be the subject of analysis and debate for many, many months and probably years ahead in terms of what really happened in this election. If I'm looking at it today, I think, to be honest with you, the big challenge that both of the main parties are facing is a lack of interest in disrupting the status quo, right? I mean, for the Liberals, that makes, I think, the most sense, given that they're the incumbent government. They're seeking re-election. Trudeau is a pretty durable brand. So, you know, you don't want to upset the apple cart. But there hasn't been sort of a key defining issue that's been presented by the team either that I think has upset the conversation into such a way that votes really were going to move towards them. So they're sort of sticking with a very strong lead or a strong position running into this election, but not some, you know, great momentum in their favor. The Conservatives are sort of, I think, facing a very similar problem. Andrew Scheer doesn't have the brand identity of a typical person poised to become prime minister. And their party really hasn't offered a great new issue, a great new debate for the parties to have had that would have defined this election. And I think that just leads to voters not really moving around as much. Without a winner to coalesce towards or an idea to get behind, it's just leading to, you know, people end up voting to the intentions that they had heading into this thing, as opposed to some change that happened during the election.
I know you might dispute this, but I've spoken to a couple of conservatives who say had they had a different leader, Justin Trudeau would be on the floor. They'd be wiping the floor with Trudeau if it was somebody like a Peter McKay or somebody else. The reality is they've got the leader they've got, and they have to stick with him, although there's already some buzz going on about how if it doesn't work out for Andrew Scheer, if he doesn't win this with a prime minister who was seen as very vulnerable, that Andrew Scheer is in trouble when there's a leader. Leadership review next year. What about your guy, though? What about Justin Trudeau? What if he pulls this out by a whisker, Dan, and the liberal strategists, the knives come out behind closed doors? You know, I was speaking to Christy Clark recently, former premier of BC, and she said this. She said, you know, if Trudeau doesn't do all that well, even if he comes out slightly ahead, there are going to be people who say, do we want this guy running our party again in 2 years or maybe even 3-4 years from now? Do you think Trudeau is in trouble?
Look, there's a million different ways that we can predict this election is going to run course. But sort of, I think if we're going to talk about it in the context that you just described, at least, you know, I'd say if Justin Trudeau remains the prime minister after this election, either through winning the most seats or through some sort of, you know, progressive alliance in the House of Commons, if he remains prime minister, he's going to have that job. He's going to stick around. I don't think knives come out for him in the kind of way you're describing in that situation.
What if he does stay on as prime minister, but it's very, very close? And you know, I'm just wondering whether somebody like a Chrystia Freeland might step forward and say, hey, listen, I need to take over the party because, you know, in reality, this is going to help us. You know, the Trudeau brand is damaged now, and I we're not sure it's ever going to come back.
I cannot predict that kind of hypothetical scenario, but what I would say, Todd, if he's the prime minister, Liberals tend not to behave that way, I would say, right? I think, if he's in that job, I think he's got that job for as long as he has the confidence of the House, to be honest with you. I don't think that you would see that kind of destabilizing force internally, at least I'm not seeing and not hearing it.
What sort of effect would a progressive alliance, and I think there, you know, this talk of coalition government is a little bit overblown. I think it's, you know, there's a lot of sound and fury, and I'm not sure how much it signifies, to sort of paraphrase Shakespeare. But this notion that, you know, you've got Jagmeet Singh, you've got the NDP, they're doing better than anybody thought they would do at the beginning of this campaign. That could be, frankly, Dan, a result of people being you know, sort of disillusioned with Scheer, but also with your guy, with Justin Trudeau. What does that do, though, to a Liberal government? How beholden would you guys actually be to the New Democrats if they would support you on an ad hoc basis? Not a formal coalition, they're not in cabinet, but they kind of prop you guys up.
Yeah, I think it really depends on, you know, where the seats end up, you know, being distributed on after the election. It's going to be a big question about what size that minority government is. I think, you know, we're talking about predictions here. The one thing that we can all safely predict at this point is that it's very, very unlikely anyone is going to win a majority government on Monday. And so we will be looking at some form of minority with support in the House of Commons from different areas. If it's the Conservatives, I think, you know, that win the most seats, it'll be really interesting to watch the Bloc and how they behave, right? It looks like the Bloc are on the trajectory to win a lot more seats in Quebec, and so they're going to be a force as well. If it is the Liberals, obviously they'll be seeking the support on their motions of confidence, or their items of confidence, I should say, budgets and whatnot, from the New Democrats and the Greens. I don't know how many seats they're going to have, and so that's really, I think, going to dictate how that arrangement ends up sorting out. But we do have recent precedents. We have precedent in Ontario. The 2011 election led to a Liberal minority that required the support of the NDP to get things passed. We have seen these parties work together in this way before, and so I think we can expect to see some course like that over the coming years.
Are you exhausted, Dan?
I think we all are. I think everybody's ready for this thing to be over.
Dan Moulton, Liberal strategist. You're listening to Viewpoints, the podcast, our best interviews from our nationally syndicated talk radio show. If you're looking for smart, fun radio to get you thinking, this is the place. We'd love to hear from you. So if you have comments or questions, feedback for us or suggestions, send us an email, viewpoints@bellmedia.ca. Again, viewpoints@bellmedia.ca. All right, let's get back to more of those viewpoints right now. It's been called the ugliest, nastiest, dirtiest federal election campaign in Canadian history. I've covered 7 or 8 of them myself as a journalist. I can tell you that's a pretty fair assessment. Fear-mongering, scaremongering, personal attacks, vicious insults, targeting character, racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, just some examples. Whether we're talking about some of the leaders, right down through to the candidates, some of the stuff we've seen on social media, there really is no one defining theme of this campaign either. It's a pretty sure bet, though, that a lot of Canadians, maybe you're one of them out there, tired of all the mudslinging in what has really been a most un-Canadian and uncivil race. My guest on the line is Clive Verrone. He's author, marketing strategist, political commentator. The name of his book, Spin, Politics and Marketing in a Divided Age. What do you make of the tone of this campaign, Clive?
Well, I have to say that I'm not entirely surprised. I think it's, you know, this is the age in which we live. And social media, a divided electorate, divided politics, this is the age we're living in. But one of the things that we are dealing with is a disappearance of the middle ground in politics. You know, it used to be that you'd have people on the left, you'd have people on the right, but on most subjects, on most matters, there was a big overlap between those two sides. Now you see a big trough between these two ends of the political spectrum, and that trough is just growing wider and deeper over time. And so that, coupled with, you know, the social media age in which we live, I'm afraid all of this negativity was kind of inevitable.
What about the negativity directed personally at Justin Trudeau? I mean, it's one thing to disagree with someone's politics or think that they are an elitist and they're out of touch and they're, you know, a spoiled kid of privilege, all that kind of stuff. But it's another thing to really go after them in such a kind of, you know, sort of gut-level way. And, you know, some of the stuff you see on social media is just astonishing. But even some of the messaging that's come from the other parties, particularly the Conservatives, after him, really trying to say that this guy is, I mean, I understand perhaps not as advertised, but going much further than just that.
I agree with you. I think, you know, we've entered into an age where American political strategy is starting to influence, certainly on the right in Canada, political tactics. And from the very beginning of this campaign, Andrew Scheer's attacks have been highly personal against Trudeau. attacking his character. They recently ran on their Facebook feed an ad calling him, a liar, and things like that. There are all of these other strange stories coming out in the peripheral media. There's some Buffalo newspaper called the Buffalo Chronicle, which has been hugely discredited as just a source of, fake news, publishing rumors, unfounded statements about Trudeau. It's been a malicious personal attack on this guy. For the most part, he has tried to stay above the fray, but it's very difficult to do. What the political strategists on the right have figured out is it doesn't matter if it's true or not. Just getting the rumors out there starts to seed doubts in people's minds. I think that the great example is what they learned during the Clinton election, the Hillary Clinton election. You know, remember all those hearings they had on Benghazi and all those other things, her emails, what have you. There was absolutely nothing wrong with anything that went on there, but the endless hearings, the endless scenes of her on TV having to answer questions about these supposed scandals created doubt in people's minds. I heard so many people say about Hillary Clinton, I just don't trust her. But they couldn't tell you why they didn't trust her. That's because they had seeded this incredible amount of doubt. And that's what they've been trying to do with Trudeau. And I think somewhat successfully here, which is to create a feeling of doubt, dishonesty, untrustworthiness around his character.
Clive Verone is my guest here on the show, author, marketing strategist, political commentator. And the other thing that I find remarkable is that neither Justin Trudeau nor Andrew Scheer have been able to break out of this sort of deadlock, this stalemate. Here we are coming in for a landing. The election's almost upon us, and things are just so close. So, you know, if Andrew Scheer is going after Trudeau for you know, his ethical lapses, lack of leadership, reckless spending, just a terrible guy, and the Liberals are going after the Conservatives for all the cuts they're going to do, reopening social issues like abortion, and whether that's true or not, you know, why is neither of them doing better, in other words? Why is it so close?
Well, Andrew Scheer's great accomplishment in this election has been to stand completely still in the polls. You know, it reminds me of that old expression, going to work for a large organization. It's like stepping onto a train that's going 100 miles an hour. Are you going 100 miles an hour? Or is the train going 100 miles an hour and you're just standing still? I think this election has been a train going 100 miles an hour and Andrew Scheer remaining completely still. You know, the Conservatives are polling now at around a third of the population in terms of their support. That has remained steady for the last several weeks. It hasn't budged. Despite all the things that have happened in the interim, nothing has moved. And he hasn't been able to shift beyond that core that he began with and attract new voters into his corral. When you listen to him talk, his appeal is inevitably to his base. He has done nothing to spread his message to a broader audience. It's a very, very odd and baffling strategy to me, and it would explain why he hasn't been able to move those numbers at all. The Liberals, on the other hand, have seen some declines. You know, they have they've been in a tight race, but over time, their numbers have decreased. So they're on a slight downward trajectory at the moment, which doesn't look good for them. And their only hope now is that Ontario comes through, where they still have enormous strength and are pacing well ahead of the Conservatives, both in the 905 and in the 416 region in Toronto.
Yeah, you wonder as well about the sort of weakness of the leaders in the sense that Trudeau has not been able to capitalize on what you were saying about the Conservative leader, the fact that a lot of Canadians don't know him, the fact that there hasn't been a real issue in this campaign, that there isn't necessarily a huge appetite for change. And yet, you know, he's in this dogfight with someone who, you know, only became leader of the Conservatives after more than 12 ballots and a very tight finish against Maxime Bernier. So definitely Scheer, you know, has a lot of vulnerabilities, and yet Trudeau has not been able to push above that. He, of course, is dealing with his own issues as well. And I guess, you know, Canadians are sort of saying, I'm not sure we like either of these people. I mean, they're kind of disillusioning us and disappointing us. So maybe it's the least bad choice, Clive?
I think that's exactly right. And I think the real danger for the Liberals is not people flipping to one of the other parties, it's people just not going out to vote. And I think that's one of the things that this recent announcement by Obama endorsing Trudeau is interesting, because there is a significant, I think, segment of the voting base who voted for Trudeau last time and were going to vote for him again. But then all these scandals erupted and they thought to them, and now they're thinking to themselves, well, I don't know if I want to vote for him again. And those people are most likely to stay home. The problem is they don't have a justification to go and vote for him again. Imagine those people last weekend at Thanksgiving, you know, sitting around the table and somebody says, who are you going to vote for this time around? And them saying, well, I think I'll vote for Trudeau again. And then the outcry over blackface and SNC and what have you. They didn't have a clear justification. What Obama's announcement did is it gave them a justification for voting for Trudeau. It said they can now say, if it's good enough for Obama, it's good enough for me. They don't need to get into any policy debates, into any discussion about character. They simply have a simple, powerful justification to go out and vote. The Liberals have to vote, they have to hope that enough of those people are motivated now to go out and vote because they have the right justification to do so.
Clive Verone was my guest, joining us on the line from Toronto. He's a marketing strategist, political commentator, and the author of the book Spin, Politics and Marketing in a Divided Age. This is Viewpoints, the podcast. And a quick note from us to you, you can listen to our full nationally syndicated radio show on weekends right across Canada on different Bell Talk radio stations. Check your local listings for those. Meantime, if you want to contact me via social media, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. Same handle for both of those, at ToddCTV. And we are back. This is a cool story, a classic puzzle game that goes back decades. Tetris, maybe you've played it. You've probably heard of it. It involves those colorful blocks that you move around to fit into a grid. Here's something, though, very interesting. Brain researchers are now studying champion Tetris players, studying their brains to map how they become champions, the complex strategies they use, every keystroke, how they rotate those shapes, their problem-solving abilities. It's a bit of a rethink, too. A lot of people dismiss video games as silly and stupid and stuff for kids, but of course, video games are hugely popular nowadays, and something like Tetris may have a lot of lessons for us in terms of human cognition. Carmi Levy is back on the line in London, Ontario. He's a tech journalist. He's been looking into this story and what the researchers are planning to do with Tetris. Carmi, great to have you on, and what's going on here?
Well, you know, it's an interesting one, Todd. Tetris, of course, you know, the incredibly viral game, been around for 3.5 decades. All of us have probably played it at one time or another. Most of us were probably addicted. And what they're doing is they're from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, a bunch of cognitive science researchers. And they've been studying this for a while, and they're kind of ramping up their research now. They're looking at Tetris players, especially the ones who are the best in the world. There's a classic Tetris World Championship, apparently, and they're going to this event, and they're wiring up competitors to understand what goes through their mind when they play, what sets them apart from people who maybe don't play Tetris or play it not so well. How do they learn over time? How do they figure stuff out? And so it's really a new kind of research, because up until now, most of the research around video games has been, is it good for our kids? Does it make them more violent? Does it contribute to addictive behavior? What this does, it says, we're really not studying the game. We're studying how people play the game as a means of understanding how we learn. And if we can unlock that, then we can maybe figure out how we can learn other things, maybe learn a language better, maybe learn a skill. The Office of the Navy in the U.S. is funding this, maybe create better sailors, create better students, who knows? But it's not so much about the game as it is about learning, and that to me is what makes this so fascinating.
So there's a strategy, of course, involved in Tetris, and there's the cognitive skills, and you're trying to solve these puzzles, but it sort of helps to expand your brain, the elasticity, the cognitive skills required to play Tetris and I guess be a champion at Tetris.
That's exactly it. It's not just understanding where your skills are at, but really it's sort of digging underneath that one layer down, saying, how did you get to that level? How did you sort of move the bar? What were the techniques that you used? In this case, to becoming a better Tetris player, but in another case, it could be becoming a better surgeon. So by unlocking those keys in the minds of the Tetris players, they can then create a template or a roadmap that other people can use to learn better. And they're also looking at other indicators of behavior. So, for example, what if you're playing, and they did this with League of Legends, which I found really neat. They looked at how people play collaboratively as a team. So, you know, when you're sitting around the living room and everyone's got a controller in their hand, they were looking at nonverbal cues that players use with each other. And can that help us learn better? Can that help us communicate better when we're working as a team toward a common goal? So, again, not really so much about League of Legends, but it's really about, well, you're sitting around the conference table at work and you're trying to figure something out in a collaborative environment. What are the cues that you should be looking for? What are the indicators? What levers should we be turning so that your team can perform better than, say, the competition? Which, you know, is really amazing, because we've never really looked at games in this way. Most people think, video games, they dismiss it. It's something that kids play. It's something that overgrown adults play who never quite grew up in the basement. Not so much. You know, we can learn a lot, and that knowledge can be applied in some really cool areas, in areas we would not have even believed possible before this research was done.
Carmi Levy in London, Ontario, tech analyst, journalist. It is interesting, too, because you're right, video games do get a bad rap, and there are some, of course, perhaps deservedly so, and others, such as Tetris, that sort of are in their own league, really, that they, you know, push us in certain ways, and they're not really considered, you know, video games in the classic sense, even though they've been around for a long, long time. So there's a bit of a rethink, too, because video games, as we all know, are extremely popular and getting even more so with younger people and older people as well. And there are all sorts of different genres within the video game subculture.
Exactly. And I think because they are so mainstream, because all of us can relate to them so well, it gives them a very large pile of data to work with. This isn't just some fringe activity. We all play certain, you know, different games of varying complexity, of varying age. Some are classic, some are retro, some are new. But all of us are part of this now. And so the researchers are going, hey, we have this huge database to work with, and we can keep adding to it. We can keep going back to the Tetris World Championships. We can keep going to people's living rooms and wiring them up, and we can keep looking at them. And then we'll come home with terabytes of data that we can then study and gain even more insight. And so, you know, it's all a matter of, you know, what is research? It's about gathering as much information as you possibly can and then dissecting it six ways from Sunday. Well, you know, we're all playing games, so this is the best way to get the most amount of data that will give us even more insight, more meaning, and allow us to draw more precise and usable conclusions.
We know that these researchers are going to the Tetris World Championship in Portland, Oregon. So there's obviously, you know, a front line. We've got the best of the best, and they're going to be analyzing how these champions actually play and sort of how they solve the puzzles and how they figure out, you know, exactly the best way to move forward and I guess outmaneuver some of their competitors as well. And then what do they do with that information? How do they actually figure that out? Because it's inside of people's brains, Carmi.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's where the science, you know, the cognitive science comes in, and that's probably a little bit beyond my pay grade, but You know, I trust that they're looking, and what they're saying is they're analyzing the data to understand what those cognitive differences are between the super champions and the rest of us. In other words, they're looking for those differences because they're also going to be studying regular players. And then they're going to put that data set up against the data set of the champions to look for those differences and then maybe map those to, you know, other insights that they can then, you know, sort of document the learnings from. So, you know, they know what they're looking for. They're looking for what we call deltas in the data. And once they find them, they can zero in on the specific learning traits that we should be focusing on. In other words, this is the technique that you use to improve the way that you play the game. This is the result that we see in your brain activity as you're playing Tetris. Therefore, we can map this to, say, learning a language or, you know, maybe learning how to become a police officer or studying for your PhD. All of these things can then be mapped to other activities and used to, you know, have a much more concrete, visible, usable roadmap for cognitive scientists and educational professionals to understand how we learn and how we can make it more repeatable and successful.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of chess, right, where there's this whole idea of how complicated chess is, especially for champions and the way their brains work.
Exactly. And so if we wired them up in much the same way as we're wiring up the Tetris players, we would gain similar insight. How many times when somebody plays chess at a grandmaster level do you sit there? And I've been in that audience where I sit there and I shake my head in disbelief. How did you get so good? The short answer is this research is going to give us that answer. We'll give us something that you and I can understand to maybe not be a grandmaster in chess, but maybe play another game a little bit better than we do right now, because we'll know exactly where we need to focus. We'll know exactly what tools and techniques and what to practice in order to get better. It's almost like a roadmap for learning, which we haven't had up until now. Because if we had it, let's face it, our schools at all levels would be more successful than they were. I'm willing to bet that the educators of the future would love to get their hands on this data.
Carmi Levy was joining us from London, Ontario, tech analyst, with his take on using Tetris and champion Tetris players to study the human brain. All right, and we've got a lot more of those viewpoints coming up in the podcast. Meantime, leave a review for us, what you think of our show. Spread the word as well. We love to get feedback. Connect with us on social media. If you like what you're hearing, let us know via Twitter or Instagram. You can tag me at ToddCTV is my handle for both Twitter and Instagram. And you can contact us, as always, via email as well, viewpoints@bellmedia.ca. Pop culture time here on the show as we come in for a landing. It's considered one of the greatest comic books of all time. In the mid-1980s, DC came out with The Watchmen, a 12-part limited series helped to redefine superheroes. The Watchmen was about a group of tortured superheroes, misfits in a world that was very dark, disturbing, on the verge of a nuclear apocalypse. The series was violent, characters that were corrupt, deranged, homicidal, certainly morally bankrupt. Writer Alan Moore, artist Dave Gibbons helped to bring an adult comic book for adults. Turned into a movie about 10 years ago, but now HBO coming out with a brand new TV series debuting in the same universe, really inspired by The Watchmen. October the 20th, available on Crave TV here in Canada and, of course, on HBO. A lot of rave reviews for this. David Betancourt is my guest in Washington. He is a comics and culture reporter for The Washington Post. David, great to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've seen 6 of the 9 episodes of this show that's coming out on the 20th of October. What did you make of it?
It really blew me away, and I say that as someone who was very skeptical and actually not looking forward to this. I am not one of those people that thinks, now, Watchmen is one of the greatest graphic novels of all time, but I do not turn my nose up at attempted adaptations or additions to the lore. So when Zack Snyder's movie came out, I was excited to see it. When DC Comics decided to do Before Watchmen, which was kind of a look at the past of all the characters in comic book form, I really enjoyed it, especially the ones by Darwin Cook, the late, great Darwin Cook, writer and artist. But having said that, just what little had been out there on the net for us to see in terms of what this story represented, there is a white supremacist uprising kind of angle with the Rorschach gang, the 7th Cavalry, and while it was clearly they were kind of trying to channel the tone of the current climate in the United States in terms of really, you know, the tone of the country, politics, everything, there was something a little uneasy about that. You almost say, well, of all the angles they could have taken of a modernized take, that's the one. But this show, and again, I've only seen six. I haven't seen all nine episodes. But boy, does it redeem itself if you have any reservations about that. It's just a very unique, very well thought out, very deep take on a whole lot of new characters, because I think that's the thing. There are enough hints to the lore of the original story of the 80s for the diehard fans, but even if you have no idea what Watchmen is, you can go into this and really just say, wow, this is great television.
I'm so glad you said that, because I, like you, was worried when I heard about this. I thought, oh boy, you know, this is such a classic. And even, you know, the original writer, Alan Moore, has been very, very reluctant, if not outright angry, over DC Comics taking the original and sort of adapting it, making new versions, or as you said before, Watchmen, the series that traces the you know, the backstory for some of these characters. So, number one, thank you for saying that, because, you know, I now could watch this knowing that at least it's worthwhile. It's not a continuation, though, is it? I mean, it's set sort of in the same universe. They use that move, the original comic book, you know, material for, as canon, so to speak. But there's a departure. It's set in a different place and different characters.
Yes, it is. It actually takes place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The kind of the big bang moment of this universe are the Tulsa race riots of the 1920s, which actually did happen here in the United States. And what Watchmen does is goes from there and takes it to Tulsa in present day 2019. But that 2019 Tulsa, Oklahoma takes place within the realm of the original Watchmen universe. So Dr. Manhattan is still on Mars. You've got enough mentioning of the mythos to clearly see that this is the future of that place, but it's an alternate take. You know, it's you know, the showrunner's kind of saying this is what we think would have happened, but they're using that moment of the Tulsa race riots kind of as a big bang in terms of how the world is. Now, if you've read the Watchmen comics, you know that towards the end, in the very last panels, they kind of hint at a candidacy of Robert Redford for president. He's actually the president right now, and he's been president for a long time. He's handed out Redfordations, which are kind of these, you know, kind of America kind of taking a chance and trying to make amends for racial sins of the past. There's really so much going on here. It's almost, you can really pick your spots in terms of what. There's so many wow moments here. You can't just pick on one thing. There's a lot going on, but it gels really well.
We're talking to David Betancourt on the line in Washington. He is the comics culture reporter for The Washington Post about this new HBO television series called The Watchmen, and it debuts on the 20th of October, and it, of course, is a continuation of the classic comic book from DC Comics in the mid-1980s, The Watchmen, one of the greatest graphic novels of all time. You know, what do you make of the fact that not just HBO, but others, Netflix and, you know, Amazon, they're tapping into sort of dystopian superheroes? I'm thinking about, yes, The Watchmen, but also The Boys that recently came out, also based on a comic book, and next year, Jupiter's Legacy, also based on a comic book, where they sort of take the idea of superheroes and they kind of rip them apart, they flip the script, and you know, it's sort of dystopian, to put it mildly.
I think what Hollywood is learning at the moment, not just Hollywood in terms of film, but, you know, all the streaming giants as well, is there's so much more to comics than just Marvel and DC. There's so much more to superhero culture than just kind of living in this PG-13, the good guy always wins world. As we know, there are plenty of comics that show that's not the case, especially you mentioned Jupiter's Legacy, with Netflix now having Mark Millar's total library now that they've made a split with Marvel, once Marvel has, you know, moved everything over to Disney Plus. There's so much out there to adapt. And again, you know, Hollywood's a copycat league, if you will, where, you know, until this stuff stops making money, they're going to keep playing it out. And there's just, I think what you're seeing is all the execs and all the power people with decisions to make realizing that the library is a lot bigger than they thought.
David Betancourt, my guest, comics and culture reporter for The Washington Post. The Watchmen, debuting October the 20th on HBO. And that's it for us this week on the show. Our show producer, Aaron Lakoff, our technical producers, Brian Calasar and Dave Simon. If you want to get a hold of us, viewpoints@bellmedia.ca is the email address. You can connect with me on Twitter, Instagram, @ToddCTV is the same handle for both of those. And we'll be back here next week with more Viewpoints. Until then, take care of yourself.